Autobiography. The blood. The horse I was. Left to the woods. As and you, and you, and you, alone in the sea. Returning bones, a stone unwinds in the breeze. Waning gibbous, the increasing density of fall. On the shores of great silence, father's eyes. Unable to find the cry of the next door boy, spring rain. Blood orange, the curving radius of sunset. The sudden sliver of noon. After the rush, the hollow sound of the holy.
Beautiful. Welcome to Poets Cafe. We're in the cafe with two outstanding poets, Richard Gilbert and Deborah P. Kaloji. Richard is visiting us from Kumamoto, Japan, and is Associate Professor of British and American Literature at Kumamoto University. He is co-judge of the Kasamakura International Haiku Competition. Richard's poems of consciousness, contemporary Japanese and English language haiku in cross-cultural perspective, was awarded the HSA 2009 Mildred Canterman Award for Haiku Criticism and Theory. And Deborah P. Kaloji is the California Regional Coordinator for the Haiku Society of America and the moderator of the Southern California Haiku Study Group. She's published over 800 haiku and 4 chapbooks of poetry. And we welcome you back again, Deborah. So nice to have you back in the cafe.
Nice to be here.
Richard, we could spend several programs discussing, as we talked about, just the genesis of haiku, not apart from your history and all your many accomplishments. But let me start the show with a blurb from Peter Yuvo on your most current release, The Disjunctive Dragonfly, A New Approach to English Language Haiku. While nowhere denying the value of objective realism, Richard Gilbert has helped demonstrate how the innovative and, yes, disjunctive core of haiku, like the force of life itself, moves in many directions and by all means possible and sometimes impossible, illuminating both outer and inner landscapes and what is held between. He's given us what has been sorely lacking, a new vocabulary of haiku techniques. So you stated the purpose of English language readers and perhaps some writers of haiku is kind of a bourgeois view of nature poems and flowers and Zen Buddhism. What is the essential, if you can, definition of haiku, and how do modern haiku differ, and what does the word disjunctive mean in contemporary poetics? That's a big question.
Okay, yeah, so we have a day.
Yes.
If we had a day, we could talk quite a bit about that. But I'd like to just read something very quickly.
Sure.
Which in part answers that for me. And it's by Professor Haruo Shirane, and he's a professor at Columbia University. And this was from 2000, which was, you know, right at the beginning of our new millennium, and maybe this it signaled, I think, as an advance guard kind of transmission of a new possibility for haiku in English. Mm-hmm. That was really against the grain of what had come before, which you might find in R.H. Blyth translations, Henderson translations, and in other words, moving away from objective realism, mm-hmm. which was really just a brief movement of haiku and poetry in Japan and around the turn of the 20th century from the 19th. And he wrote this paragraph out of an essay called Beyond the Haiku Moment. Echoing the spirit of Basho's own poetry, haiku in English is a short poem, usually written in 1 to 3 lines, that seeks out new and revealing perspectives on the human and physical condition, focusing on the immediate physical world around us, particularly that of nature, and on the workings of the human imagination, memory, literature, and history. This definition is intended both to encourage an existing trend and to affirm new space that goes beyond existing definitions of haiku. So he was writing particularly to the English language genre people at the time, who I think had really restricted the idea of haiku in English to a kind of nature poetics.
Right. Which has started out when? Like in the 1600s or something. I mean,
In Japan?
Yeah.
I don't think in Japan haiku was ever a nature poetics in the way that we tend to unconsciously relate to it. In this way.
We relate to
when
Basha.
We say nature, we think of naturalism.
Okay.
I think that the tradition of season words, or kigo in Japanese, mm-hmm. is not a naturalistic tradition.
Okay.
And that's a very important difference. So if we take it as kind of logical positivism or science, a scientific viewpoint, like there is a bug that appears in a certain, you know, season, like a type of semi or cicada, mm-hmm. and it's this real creature. And that's the main point of a season word. I would say that from a Japanese perspective, that is really a misinterpretation. The literal aspect of the natural bug is just one small part of what the word evokes as an environment. Like one example I gave I did an interview with Tim Green at Rattle Magazine. Mm-hmm. I talked about one of the 12 cicadas that appear where I live in Kumamoto. Mm-hmm. And this one appears right in the late summer, Higurashi. Beautiful sound. They have like several chorus. They sing in a chorus, and it's I'm from Connecticut, mm-hmm. where they just our cicadas are buzzsaws. You know, they're deafening. But this one is really sweet.
Yeah.
And they start up at dusk, but they sort of signal the end of summer. And for the school kids who are on vacation, it has a really kind of poignancy of the end of summer. And my friend Hoshinaga Fumio had written a haiku that goes. Into the jump rope spinning ring, a cicada jumps in.
Beautiful.
But it's actually Higurashi jumps in, so it's that particular one.
Uh-huh.
And so this is the idea that the season word creates an environment. So of course there is that actual animal, insect, but it's also the children, and it's also the end of summer, and it's also the going back to school and the sort of sadness of that. And there they are playing jump rope, and so one more point to add is, how many other haiku are there that have used that same word in history? And to find that out, you open up the Saijiki, which is a compendium of haiku that associate to a kigo or a season word. And in that, you'll find these layers of history. So over the many generations, that same season word has been used through the eras.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a multi-generational conversation through time. Mm-hmm. And so that's why haiku is considered difficult in Japan. And one reason, there's the old kanji, but then there's also this study aspect.
Right.
That you do need to know that the kigo and how deep they are. And so when I asked Hoshinaga, well, why do you've written all forms of poetry and plays and et cetera, and he's a very talented writer. And why stick with haiku? And he said, one of the things he said was, you know, one word can create an environment. It's very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And we do miss that in English, but this is why when we translate the word kigo into season word, it's a very unfortunate literal translation, and we're kind of stuck with that. And we miss – it's like a kind of becomes culturally reductive because we don't have a compendium of season words, et cetera. So we can't make one either. I think we can't force that into existence. So – one of the interesting things for the English language haiku is, what do we do in our language through our culture with a very short form like this to make it powerful? So that's where this idea of disjunctive techniques comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to read you, here's a haiku. I'm looking at my book here called The Disjunctive Dragonfly, came out in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a small section in there which was comparing strong and weak disjunction. And I wanted to show that weak disjunction does not equal weak haiku. It's just a different style of, it's like a linguistic idea.
Right. But I just want to mention one thing here.
Go ahead.
Because you've, it's impossible for our listeners to get a conceptual understanding of the history. I mean, you're doing a beautiful job of articulating some of the aspects of it. But looking from the traditional, which is, I think, what a lot of if our listeners are familiar with haiku, they come from that traditional point of view. So how did we move out of that into the disjunctive, and what does that mean, really?
Okay. Let's start with...
Go ahead, Deb.
Well, it's sort of a side note, but in the sense that here when we're writing in English, we're relying on translations. And when you're relying on an interpretation by the people who did these early translations, so we have these misconceptions. Like we talked about the Kigo and how Kigo works in Japan versus how we try to make it work in the U.S. But then we also have this Zen thing where, you know, Zen seems to be very important to people writing in English language, but from what I understand, not so much in Japan.
Right.
And
it's
a misunderstanding of what haiku should be. And so, and that's kind of what, you know, I kind of, and then where we move into, well, can we mimic, you know, Japanese haiku, or do we even want to? Do we want to kind of find out? And that's what I think we go into with this form. So,
go ahead.
Yeah, I used a term called creative mistranslation to describe the transmission of haiku ideas from Japan into English. And you'd have to probably divide this into two different areas. One is the very innovative mistranslation, somewhat purposeful, which was done by Ezra Pound. And so, you know, you end up with the poem In a Station of the Metro, which I'll read. The apparition of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet black bough.
Yes.
Right.
Beautiful.
So this is like 1913. And it's considered, you know, one of the, maybe not the first exactly, but one of the very first modernist poems. And it started the trend toward imagism, which ended up with these certain rules, which are very haiku-like in a way, dealing with minimalism and you know, lack of ornamentation, importance of rhythm, but natural rhythm, or at least not rhythm for the sake of scansion, let's say, only in a fin de siècle way. So there's this one side where Wallace Stevens did 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, and you can look at William Carlos Williams and the objectivists like Zukowski, who Ginsberg really relied on, Reznikov. And lately, Oppen has been of a real interest to modern haiku writers. So, but these were not popular writers outside of the poetic circles. And what happened really for haiku in English was Jack Kerouac and the Beats.
Right, and you were a part of that. You knew. Well,
yeah,
some
in the later life of not Kerouac, of course, but of Allen Ginsberg, who was a friend, and you know, I studied with him in Naropa, and Gary Snyder came to Naropa, and so that I was drawn by to study there because I wanted to study with living poets who I thought were creative and interesting and working, as opposed to studying texts and interpretations and that kind of thing. So. But what I wanted to mention is that when the Dharma Bums came out, there was actually R.H. Blythe, the translator of many thousands of haiku into English, was very exciting to Gary Snyder, who had shown these books to Ginsberg and Kerouac. And there is a Blythe haiku in the Dharma Bums, and they talk about it. They talk about it in a very kind of pure, somewhat Zen-like way, let's say. Blythe himself had studied with D.T. Suzuki, but his studies were not what we would think of as real. I don't think that he was a practitioner in the sense we mean that he was really a practicing sitting meditator. So he took his own kind of version of Zen Buddhism and then applied that interpretive viewpoint to haiku. That's the misignation or the mistranslation, because he did thousands of these and his commentaries are fantastic.
Right.
But they're not scholarly or accurate, and they don't represent the mainstream tradition in Japan either. But that's how we ended up feeling about haiku, was that they were Zen-like moments of enlightenment. But my own research and knowing people in the haiku community in Japan has revealed something very different, which is they're you know, it's a deep literature that's very complex. And Zen and this idea of a moment of enlightenment is really not part of the haiku tradition in any main way.
There's also a part of that that's sort of resistant, I think. It seemed to me in the disjunctive movement, because there was this history, as I read it, about the 40 new rising haiku poets who were persecuted and imprisoned because they started to write about social issues, which of course relates to Ginsberg too, you know, and his howl. So what is that? Is that new haiku rising movement, or new rising haiku movement? Does that relate to that?
Yeah. Well, just briefly to give slight bit of background, probably certainly.
Or even share any poems if you
want. Yeah, I will. I will. I'm going
okay,
to. I'll share some.
Because we're about halfway through the show now.
Yeah.
And I want to definitely
okay.
hear some.
You'll hear
of
some
your...
anti-war haiku.
Okay, good.
But yes, even from the 1920s, there had been a very strong progressive movement in Japanese haiku.
Mm-hmm.
Experimental, communist movement, workers' haiku of realism, etc. But during what's called the 15 years wartime era from the 30s through 45, there was a lot of haiku were used as holy war haiku. There were people writing, you know, about the victory and mm-hmm. destroying enemy bases and that sort of thing. But the new Shin Undo Haijin, or the new rising haiku poets, had come out of the more progressive universities. And they were tortured. They were imprisoned.
Right.
They were sent to the front lines, and so they really risked their presses were burned. Their families were ostracized and castigated. It was really they were brave mm-hmm. and heroic in their writing of haiku, and we don't know that. And so I think of them as heroes of that war. And I'll read some now. In Japan, everything that's happened for us in terms of modernism happened for them too.
Hmm.
And that when we think of haiku, we tend to go to Basho or Busan right. or Issa, and we tend to think like, and the reverse is true too. Like maybe in Japan, my students think of Jane Austen or Shakespeare, you know, and they're not, contemporary culture is harder to grasp, but they, you know, a modern writer is a modern writer in Japan, basically,
okay.
you know. So these writers who are writing these are from the late 30s and early 40s right now. You have to just keep that in mind, that they're familiar with German Romanticism, with Nietzsche, with, you know, with
right.
Einstein, etc. Okay. Kikanju miken ni koroso hana ga saku. A machine gun in the forehead, the killing flower blooms. Saito Sanki. Senisha ga aoki sugaku yori tetari. War dead. Exit out of a blue mathematics. Sumimura Sendishi. Tareshiki o hanare kareshiki toshite utare. Leaving a dead tree, being shot as a dead tree. Sugimura Sendishi. Umete ite teki naru koto wasure itari. During burial, this is the enemy, forgetting. Hashi kageo. So those were the Shin Undo Haijin, some samples of the anti-war haiku written at the height of what we would think of as a Japanese Gestapo mm-hmm. propaganda movement, where they were all
very powerful.
How many? 42 were arrested, etc. Now, I have a couple more by Kaneko Tota, mm-hmm. who is now 94 years old.
Mm.
And we have translated 4 books on him. 2 are his selected haiku. And
yes.
his career is huge. It's like 75 years of haiku. He was in the war on the Truk Islands, Truk Lagoon. And I'll just give you a flavor. I'm not going to, you know, read
sure.
too many. But these are from that time period. They're a little bit tricky to read. Go ni neshi hitoyo no rashin fuki ni fuku. Nights in a foxhole. Night, my body naked, wiping and wiping. Tomo ni ukabu kanu no uta no bakushi no sakana. Floating together, songs from canoes and dead fish bombed. ueru shimajima ware kaijo ni tai migaki. Starved islands, I polish my body on the ocean. Waku kumogumo onore shite shime kami wo shitemu. Rising cloud upon cloud, myself to be killed, to abandon all gods.
What I find so compelling about these is just, you know, the focus on these difficult subjects. And Richard, you've written some of your own, like you have a war haiku, Be Mine, A Life for One More War.
Yes.
And I really, you know, would like to hear a few more of yours as well.
Okay. You know, that was actually somewhat related to a haiku by Hoshinaga Fumio, which I'll read. Now, Hoshinaga is a friend in Kumamoto. He's 74. Mm-hmm. And he was a child. There's the generation now that's mostly still alive. I mean, Kaneko is unusual in his 90s. But Hoshinaga, Ura Kyoko, and others are in their 70s. And so they're children growing up in the wartime. And we don't have time to go into some of the stories, but he wrote this one. Haru no ki ni noboru senso ga mieru made. The spring tree, I climb until I can see the war. Now, the reason I wanted to mention this is the Kigo is spring tree. Mm-hmm. And this is the deformation of Kigo, the deformation of the season word, like in this my very modern way. So it gets, you can see that these are translations that we feel are pretty accurate from the Japanese. And you'll notice that they're not in 5-7-5 syllables, mm-hmm. and that they just feel like modern poems.
Right.
And I think that they also really do represent the feeling of modernity and contemporaneity in the poets.
This is probably a big question, but don't answer it if it's too big, because I want more time.
But but the ones that I read, the ones that I read of the new rising haiku poets,
yes.
Imagine if the Beats had read those instead of the blank.
Right.
What I'm trying to do in a way in the translation is I'd like us to catch up, mm-hmm. you know, so that if we could just get into within the same, even two decades ago, would be so interesting because we have a lot to communicate to each other, but the language barrier is huge. I don't want us to be stuck in the past.
I wonder a little bit of how, when you're doing in the translation process, are you able to, or do you even try to kind of mirror any of the, you know, metrics that are in a poem or any of alliterative aspect.
It's really case by case.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, we're a group. There's six of us in the Konichi Haiku translation group.
Uh-huh.
And I founded it in 1996, I think, something like that. And so it's a mix, you know, we're some Japanese poets and critics and myself. I'm kind of the final polisher, and I'm trying to create haiku in English that are strong.
Yes.
Because I want the power of that original in Japanese to feel powerful in English.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many, you know, there are many ways you can do it, and sometimes you can't do it so well. But sometimes rhythm is so important in these very short poems. And sometimes there's a very interesting rhythmic element in the Japanese, and then you can try to play with that or emulate that, sure. Mm-hmm. But
do you have an example of that?
The Yagi Mikajo, we're coming out with a book of hers. And she does have some very interesting rhythmic elements. But I'm actually going to skip that just to read a couple of hers that are beautiful anyway.
Okay.
So this is Yagi Mikajo.
And just before you do that, if you tuned in just recently, we're here at Poets Cafe with haiku scholar Richard Gilbert and Deborah P. Kaloji, who's here co-hosting the show today. And we're talking about the intricacies of haiku. Go for it.
Yagi Mikajo recently passed away last year in her 80s, and she was the first female doctor, to open up her own clinic in the history of Japan. She's an ophthalmologist. She was really brilliant. There's a very interesting life. And she was also a zeine haijin, meaning she was an avant-garde haiku poet. Mm-hmm. I would call her a radical eco-feminist before the word existed, right?
Yes.
And I would like to read just a couple to give you she's just tremendous. So here's one. Mankai no mori no inbu no era kokyu. Full bloom in the forest's genitals, respiration of gills. And I'll read one more. Akakitake raizan shite wa keru ona. Worshipping it, the scarlet mushroom kicks it, a woman.
Sorry.
Didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, she wrote, that's her first book of haiku called
Beni. Read that one more time, please. Just that last one. Read that one more time.
Akakitake raizan shite wa keru ona. Worshipping it, the scarlet mushroom kicks it, a woman.
Wow.
So Benitake is actually like a Amanita muscaria. It could be. But it's also, there's a sexual nuance there. Sure. And so.
So we're running out of time, and there's so many wonderful haikus that you brought to share with us. I wonder if you wouldn't mind going out with the recent haiku you've written about Leonard Nimoy. We love him. Well, we love
it's
our
a memoriam.
Spock.
They're not about him really, but just associate. Yeah, we love him. So,
okay.
Hang on. For Leonard Nimoy in memoriam. Stars, in the natural night, one song threads another. Breath, sky breath, stars tend towards home. New places promised, shared underleaf. Eventually depth penetrating desires un. Deep in the woods, all the dancing in space. Awaiting the warm that everyone. Flower of space, one can touch about moss. Iterative reconstruction, the nation of stars.
Beautiful. Thank you. You have a website, which is?
It's sailingacrossoceans.org, sailing-across-oceans.org, and it's the Shao NPO.
Thanks for joining us, Richard and Deborah. I'm Lois P. Jones, and my guests tonight have been Richard Gilbert and Deborah Piccologi. Look for us on the Poets Cafe fan page on Facebook. You've been listening to Poets Cafe on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.